up this week as March 6th is upon us. March 8th is International Women's Day. Well, it's time for me to go. Labor Hour. They've got some great stuff, including a guy talking about Venezuela as well. And stay around for that. Thanks for listening. Two choices of old-timey music early in the evening if you want to check your local listings.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois, and webcasting live worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217 328-2295. And also, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We're going to be having two guests call in today. First, here in about 7-8 minutes, we're going to be having a man call in who lives in Venezuela to tell us a little bit what's actually going on down there. Because if you're getting all your information from the corporate media about what's going on in Venezuela right now, you're very badly misinformed. And he's going to tell us what's really going on. And then at half past the hour, we're going to be hearing from a union school teacher from Lorain County, Ohio, which is just outside Cleveland, Ohio, Joshua Thornsberry. Him and two dozen other union members became fed up with the local Democratic Party and their betrayals of working people, and they decided to run for a whole bunch of local offices, and most of them got elected and on an independent Labor Party ticket. So he's going to be calling and telling us a little about what led to that and how they did it. So stay tuned, and we will bring you those two reports. So in the meantime, I guess think Bob might have a new story that he wants to share with us.
Yeah, Dave, I'm actually going to contrast a couple different politicians here a little bit.
Okay.
Tie them in with United Auto Workers and union votes and things like that.
Okay.
Last week, the United Auto Workers Union filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board after losing an election at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, alleging that the anti-UAW comments from Senator Bob Corker and other prominent state Republicans amounted to outside interference. Corker's statements in particular, which suggested the planned expansion of the plant could be at risk depending on the outcome of the election, were cited by the UAW as leading many workers to vote against unionization. And here's quotes here. He says, "I've had conversations, and based on those am assured that should the workers vote against the UAW, Volkswagen will announce in the coming weeks that it will manufacture its new mid-sized SUV here in Chattanooga," Corker told reporters on the first day of the three-day election. So that's why United Auto Workers have filed charges. Since then, Volkswagen hasn't made any kind of announcement that the new stuff would go into Chattanooga or anything like that. I'm going to contrast that with this gentleman who passed away this week, Chokwe Lumbamba.
Mm-hmm.
He was the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi.
Yes, interesting man.
And, very interesting man. And he was on the side of the unions down there. There is a Nissan plant right outside of Jackson, Mississippi, in Canton, Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
about 10 miles away. And he was all for the workers down there. And like you say, he was an interesting man. He was a lawyer. He defended black nationalists and radicals, prisoners, and other individuals had contended that the government was violating their human and civil rights. And this work won him admirers on the left. And Lumumba's political and legal work made him a monster to some voters in the mayoral election. But I understand that he was overwhelmingly voted into as mayor of Jackson, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
So they say here, unions aren't the only ones lamenting the loss of Lumumba. After the mayor's death, even those who had been his loudest critics sang his praises. The newspaper down there, the conservative Clarion Ledger newspaper, editorialized, "Lumumba's legacy should be the city's guide." And Reverend James Sims reminded the crowd that Lumumba was a comrade in the struggle for the union at Nissan and an ally of blue-collar folks. He thought everyone needs a voice, especially in big factories, and for everyone to have an opportunity to make decisions without interference by the employers. So Lumumba's pro-union, pro-worker ideals are a critical component of his legacy. And I talked to some people. I haven't been to Jackson, Mississippi mm-hmm. for years, but talked to some people that have been there recently and said that that city was really booming under his leadership.
Okay.
There was more construction going on there. There was revitalization of downtown Jackson and stuff. So mm-hmm. Interesting that these two politicians had totally different views. One is working for the people, and one seems to be working against them, you know? So,
yeah, I remember stopping late 2 a.m. one time on the way to New Orleans in Jackson at a Waffle House downtown Jackson. And, I mean, that was back in, when was that? I think about 97.
Yeah.
And, in fact, Tom Thomas and I were the ones who went down to New Orleans. And, man, that was, I mean, it was, seemed like a really depressed city at that time. And I understand that this guy had to, this mayor of Jackson had to float some bond issues in order to get a whole bunch of infrastructure work done. I mean, and this seemed like this was kind of the initial catalyst to get a lot of this, a lot of these projects going that you were referring to.
He raised taxes and stuff on a lot of different things.
Okay.
But he was putting that money to good use in that, you know. That guy, he grew up in Detroit, Michigan, earned his law degree, and became active in the Republic of New Africa movement, a group that was demanding reparations for slavery and the establishment of a largely African-American country in five southern states, including Mississippi.
Oh, wow.
So this guy had some radical issues in his past.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was 66 years old. And evidently was doing some really good things down there in Jackson and was on the side of the union workers or people that are trying to get a union into that Canton, Mississippi Nissan plant down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole UAW story is interesting. There's been all sorts of articles over the internet and really interesting. A lot of factors. I mean, last things I've followed is Volkswagen. Wants the union because,
they want workers' councils like they have at the plants in Germany.
Yes.
And they're comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. And, well, they think it's going to help productivity. It probably does, you know, to one degree. But, you know, on the other hand, there's some other articles showing that, you know, the anti-union forces in the factory, in the VW factory, were mainly salaried lower managerial workers, and they were speaking out against the union, and they were easily able to show the UAW union track record of being that basically, why should you pay union dues for a union that's not going to represent you? And they presented a lot of facts. I mean, about how the UAW in the last 30 years has been negotiating all sorts of concessionary contracts, two-tier wage structures. I mean, just a very company-friendly union. And, of course, this has been some bad stuff that we've covered here in the Labor Hour, like the Henderson, Kentucky workers that were on strike for over a year, and their own UAW International Union sold them out to the company. Also has happened again in Cleveland, North Carolina, which we also covered back a few years ago. So, you know, in some ways, the UAW has themselves to blame for this, for not having a Democratic union that actually fights for the interests of the workers. You know,
that's one of the things you and Bill always talk about here is a Democratic union that is working for the workers and not working for the contractors and things.
Yes, you know? And I mean, frankly, I don't know. Sometimes it's a close call about whether workers in particular location or would be better off with no union or with a bad union. I mean, I always kind of inclined to think a bad union would be better than no union at all. But on the other hand, you think about it, if you're paying dues, monthly dues, I mean, why should you pay money to somebody that's not going to represent your interests? It'd be like going out and hiring an attorney, and the attorney's working for the prosecution or not working for you at all, just laying down. So I can see both sides of it, and it's a real shame if UAW had more of a representative, you know, more representation, they wouldn't have been able to do that. I mean, it just made it easy for them. So it's you know, it's interesting. It's a story about how the anti-union forces in this country, and it's a story about the corporatization of a lot of unions and how neither one is good for working people.
There were other outside forces involved in that Chattanooga, Tennessee, too, you know, like Grover Norquist and people like that.
Oh, yes.
Put in a lot of outside money to put ads up, billboards and TV commercials and things like that, and influence a lot of people in the area.
Of course, they're afraid that if a union gets established in that area, that it's going to, you know, it's going to have spinoffs into other places, other industries, and that sort of thing. So that's where they're coming from.
Right.
You know, but I guess, you know, we'll see how this develops. You know, it's kind of an interesting case where you see a company that's actually, in fact, I heard that Volkswagen was threatened not to do any expansion for the, you know, start building the SUV until they get the union in there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is just kind of a little topsy-turvy for what you normally see, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're listening to the World Labor Hour. We're going to take a quick music break here. We're waiting for a caller to call in to give us a report about what's going on in Venezuela. So stay tuned. Woo!
is out forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. Today the policeman's a union man, brother firefighter's my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. That's why my friend the blood tastes good every time I'm here. I got a will to win and a Cheshire grin. Yeah, the night watchman is near, and you can't get it where you're at, but you can sure get it here. So come rain or sleet or dark or night, come wind or frigid snow, there's 100,000 in the streets, and that number's gonna grow. And when we put the governor on trial, I'll be in the front row. Just take a look around, we're a union town. 1, 2, 3, 4, let's go. This is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. Oh.
Okay, that was Tom Morello in Uniontown, and you know, we're kind of still waiting here for our caller to call in, and we're hoping that they do. But I just thought, you know, real quick here, I might want to just to mention some of the background about what's been going on in Venezuela. And it's interesting here, you know, over the 10-year period from 2000 to 2010, the U.S. government has channeled more than $100 million to opposition groups in Venezuela. Even this year, Obama included $5 million in the 2014 foreign operations budget for opposition groups in Venezuela. As a State Department cable from the U.S. Embassy in Caracas, published by WikiLeaks, explained in March 2009, quote, without our continued assistance, it is possible that the organizations we helped create could be forced to close. Now, if you listen to the U.S. media, first of all, a little background. I mean, Venezuela, you know, up until 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected president, was really bad shape. I mean, you know, it was never a very it was a very stretched imagination to call it a democracy at that time, because you had a small group of very wealthy elites who ran the country, and when they food prices and fuel prices and stuff and transportation prices were raised back in it was 89, I believe it was. People took to the streets, and there was a huge massacre of people by the police. That this was, I think, a short time after that is when Hugo Chavez and some other junior military officers in the Venezuelan army actually tried to do a coup against the government because of that massacre, and they ended up losing, and he went to jail for a while and everything. But when he got out, he was considered such a national hero to the people that he won in a pretty significant margin the first time he's elected. And you know, he died just last year, and all this time, every time he ran for election, he always won by pretty significant margins, because During his presidency, I mean, there's all sorts of things he did to help the average Venezuelan. But the thing is that the U.S. United States government and corporate interests they represent, of course, hated Hugo Chavez and hate the current Venezuelan government because they're actually, you know, doing things for the people, as opposed to the usual thing that had been done in the past, which was basically allow U.S. corporations and other multinational corporations pretty much rob and plunder the economy. Says here, during the past decade in Venezuela, poverty has been reduced by over 50%. Healthcare has become free and accessible to all. Quality education from primary through graduate school has been available for free. State subsidies provide affordable food and housing for those in need, as well as job training programs and worker placement. Media outlets, especially community media, have expanded nationwide, giving more space for the expression of diverse voices. Internet access has increased significantly, and the state also built hundreds of public info centers with free computer internet access throughout the country. Students are given free laptops and tablets to use for their studies, and the government has raised the minimum wage by 10 to 20% each year, leading Venezuela to have one of the highest minimum wages in Latin America. Pensions are guaranteed after only 25 years of work, and those who work in the informal economy are still guaranteed a pension from the government. So, I mean, this is, you know, what, of course, is not reported, you know, in the U.S. media. I mean, the U.S. media echoing the sentiments of the U.S. government is openly encouraging violent regime change in Venezuela. A story from yesterday, from a few days ago, was aired on NPR, considered a liberal media source. In short, this piece featured claims of Venezuela at the precipice of economic collapse and spoke in glowing terms of the opposition's hopes for a coup to overthrow President Maduro. This type of reporting is not only responsible, but, you know, deeply misinforms the American people. Okay, I think that might be our caller, so we'll see here. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Yes, this is Dada calling.
Yes.
My name is Dada Maheshwaranda, and I was interested in talking a little bit about Venezuela.
Yes, please. I just gave a little background to the listeners, sort of basically what happened prior to Hugo Chavez's election back in the late 90s and what's happened since he was elected, and then, of course, him dying about a year ago. But, you know, we're seeing all sorts of stories in the U.S. media that supposedly what's you tell us what's going on right now down in Venezuela, because you just you lived there, and you're here in the U.S. for a visit, and you just came to the U.S. about a week or so ago. So what's been happening down there?
Right. It's very interesting what's happening, David. The opposition to the government is protesting, and part of the opposition to the government has decided to take a violent stance, to burn government, any government vehicle they find, to create barricades, burning barricades, throw stones, throw Molotov cocktails, prepare Molotov cocktails. They're in a fight against the government. They said their original goal was to bring down the government, and now they say another goal is they must bring down the president because of the deaths that have occurred.
Mm-hmm.
19 deaths have occurred as of last night. One death is too many, of course.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrible tragedy.
Yes.
At the same time, the majority of the people, 50% of the population, is clearly supporting the government. Personally, I think it's a tragic cycle of violence, escalating violence.
Mm-hmm.
I think negotiations would be a much better way to try to respond to the protests. But, you know, 50% of the population of Venezuela, they say, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
We're
mm-hmm.
not, you know, we have free health care for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
We have doubled the number of students in higher university education. We have poverty rate has gone down 50%, absolute poverty down 70%. The actual economy has been growing on an average of 4.3% mm-hmm. every year.
Now, I understand that there are some
shortages.
Yes, I understand there's some shortages. And from what I've been able to gather, you know, from independent sources on the internet, is what's happened is a lot of wealthy business people have been hoarding goods. I mean, to try to sabotage the economy. Have you heard any of those stories?
Of course, and it's partially true, and partially it's also true that the government's inefficient.
Okay.
And so, you know, all the things that are needed are not arriving on time,
mm-hmm.
and there's inefficiencies. sometimes is corruption mm-hmm. by some government officials.
Mm-hmm.
There are problems.
Yes.
But I want to point out that though there are shortages of cooking oil sometimes you have to wait in line in the supermarkets to get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pain in the neck. I don't like to do that.
Yeah.
I don't have to go to one, two, or three supermarkets, four supermarkets, looking for milk powder, looking for this or that.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's no hunger.
Yeah.
And that's very significant. I mean, you might not get exactly what you want, but there's no question of hunger in the country. There are government relief programs. There are subsidized free kitchens in all the poor barrios. I mean, it's very impressive that there is no hunger.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are shortages, and it's a pain in the neck.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though. I just was talking about how the Obama administration just approved, how much was it? $5 million for 2014 to support these opposition groups that are causing a lot of the violence. I mean, you know, the Maduro, after Chavez died, was eventually elected in an election, if I remember
right.
correctly. So, I mean, he's a democratically elected president. In fact, even Jimmy Carter in the Carter Center said that, you know, that the Venezuelan election this time, as well as all the times previously, you know, when Chavez was elected, has been mm-hmm. very free, fair, and transparent. So,
exactly.
And I mean, so I just, you know, it's a. It's,
and David,
yes.
David mm-hmm. you know, in the United States, it's completely against the law for any foreign nation
mm-hmm.
to contribute to any political campaign of any, you know, senator, congressman, president, anything.
True. Yes.
It's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's not illegal for the United States government to finance political campaigns of candidates they want against candidates they don't want in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely a double standard.
You mentioned it's correct, $5 million has been allocated for this
mm-hmm.
officially.
Officially, yes.
But there's a lot of unofficial money, like $100 million over the last 15 years
mm-hmm.
that has gone through other entities, Democratic, right-wing, conservative think tanks
mm-hmm.
that, that in the name of democracy then finance opposition groups against the present government.
Yes.
So that's happening a lot. And it's hypocrisy that the government does not allow it. Foreign mm-hmm. countries to do that on their soil, but they don't mind doing it on other countries' soil.
Yes. Yeah, and so I think it's, you know, I definitely want to get you back on the air sometime here, you know, down the road in the future to give
Good.
Us another report, because I think it's really interesting, you know, what's been happening, and you've lived there for a while, and I think it gives us a good perspective and stuff. So I just would like to thank, unfortunately, we're kind of short on time today, but I just wanted to squeeze you in for just a short report anyway to let our listeners
Great.
Know what's kind of what's really going on as opposed to what's being said in the U.S. corporate media. So Donna, thank you so much for calling in, and we definitely want to get you back on the air here sometime soon.
Thank you, David.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay, that was Dada Mahesh Veranda calling, who lives in Venezuela, but he happens to be here in the United States for a two-week visit, and just happened, it was good timing on our part to where we were able to, you know, get him to call in. But yes, I mean, you know, at the very least, I mean, it's like, you know, we got enough problems here in this country. I mean, we don't need to be interfering in other countries' internal affairs, and especially spending. You know, they say we're broke. We got to make cuts to Social Security. We got to make cuts to Medicare. Oh, we don't have money for this. But boy, it sure seems like they have no problems pulling huge sum of monies out of a hat for either a war or interfering in other countries' internal affairs. So it seems like this is our next caller. Hello, WFT. You're on the air.
Hey, this is Councilman Joshua Thornsberry calling in.
Hi, Joshua. How you doing? And
good. How are you?
Good, good. So we have Joshua Thornsberry on the line calling in from, this is Lorain County, Ohio. What town or city do you actually live in Lorain County?
It is the city of Lorain, but
the city
county
Lorain.
Of Lorain.
Okay, it's like us with the city of Champaign and the county of Champaign. Okay, very good.
Correct.
So anyway, it's, you know, it's interesting. You've been getting a fair amount of press here, here and there, labor notes and other kind of labor-oriented publications about what you and about two dozen other or so union members did back during the election, back before the first of the year. Could you just give us a little background on that?
Yeah, it's definitely humbling to be doing a radio show from out of state here. It just started as a small movement of union leaders that were frustrated with the Democratic Party local here, not really representing the ideas and beliefs of labor, and just finally had enough and decided to stand up and endorse independent candidates like myself and others, and just to make a stand that you know the Democratic Party can't take the labor vote for granted, which seems to be what's happening around here.
Yeah, in fact, I don't think you're alone in that. That seems to be, I think, pretty prevalent throughout the whole United States. And I guess the big difference is you guys actually did something about it other than just complain about it.
Yeah, I think that's the key, too, nationally, is you know, if any group blindly supports one political party or the other one, I think what's the end result is you will eventually be taken for granted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the parties are competing for your vote, you tend to have a better position. And I think that's kind of where we are here in Lorain County is the union leaders are going to support those that support them. So they might endorse Republicans or Democrats or independents like myself. You know, whoever the best candidate is, that's going to stand up and fight for the middle class and fight for labor.
Okay. Now, what are some of the largest unions in your area? You're a union school teacher. Are you with the NEA or the AFT? Or
I'm with the OEA, which is affiliated through the NEA.
Okay.
The largest unions, UAW.
Okay.
We have two local Ford plants here. One, unfortunately, is shut down now. Steelworkers, huge steelworkers union here. And then all kinds of trade unions. And then the public unions, the teachers, the cops, and the firefighters.
Okay.
Tend to be the largest groups.
Okay. And so, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you personally ran against the head of the local Chamber of Commerce, you know, and you ended up beating him in the election. And, you know, I just find this really fascinating that a lot of people, because obviously it must have taken more than just union members to get votes from in order to win. Did you have to build some kind of coalition outside of union members?
Oh, yeah, that was definitely our biggest task. I live in an area that I would say is probably 70% Democrat, 30% Republican, independent.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely had to get Republicans and independents to support us. And we found that to be much easier than we thought it was going to be. They're pretty fed up with what I call the Good Old Boys Club here in Lorain. So they were supporting us because we were not part of that group. And then from the Democratic, from the 70% of the Democrats, I would say about just under half of those are union households.
Okay.
So once we secured the independent and Republican vote and peeled off the union vote from the Democrats, mm-hmm. we had a pretty easy time. We won it pretty comfortably. I think it's 56 to 44.
Oh, wow. Now, when you say the Republican vote, you're talking, I imagine, rank and file working people who tend to vote Republican? I mean, because I couldn't see the official Republican Party endorsing you guys. Or, I mean, what happened there?
Yeah, you know, the official Republican Party, Lorain is almost a single-party city.
Mm-hmm.
There's one elected official at the county level that's Republican who did support us.
Mm-hmm.
There are no elected Republicans within the city of Lorain.
Okay.
So it's a very small group. It was surprising, you know, having the labor support that we had, that we were also able to get the Republican support. I mean, some pretty conservative Republicans. I remember we had a fundraiser and you know, these guys are sitting at a table together that are usually on opposite sides.
Yeah.
But we were able to get them to come together to support us. Again, they are the Republicans, even though there are not a lot of them in the city of Lorain, they're just so fed up with the good old boy system
mm-hmm.
around here that even though labor was supporting us, they were going to support us as well.
I see. Okay. So now these were all city councilor seats, or were there some other county offices or city offices involved?
You know what? It was mostly city council seats,
okay.
But I think there were a few other ones, maybe a couple judge races.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
There's 24 different candidates that were supported by the Lorain County AFL-CIO that ended up winning their elections. There might have been one or two Republicans, five or six independents, and then the rest were Democrats that were pro-labor Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what we're seeing here. There's almost a civil war within the Democratic Party in this county, where half the Democratic Party is supported by labor, and then the other half is very against labor. And that's what tends to happen, I think, in a single party system is you still have fighting. It's just fighting within the party.
Yes.
You know, in the city I live in, the term I used on the campaign trail was pretendocrats. You know, there's a lot of people in the Democratic Party of Lorraine who, if they live someplace else, would be registered Republicans. They're anti-union, they're pro-business, but they know they can't win as a Republican in the city of Lorraine, so they pretend to be Democrats.
Yes.
So I chuckled. That's kind of what's happening here.
I chuckled because we have a similar situation here. In fact, we're going through a Democratic primary state representative race. And we've got a candidate, an African-American woman who's a community activist, been involved in the community for years. Husband's a union steward with SEIU at the university. And she's got a proven track record, you know, of over 10 years. Plus, she was also a county board member and currently a city council member. And she's running against some guy that just came out of nowhere as a corporate attorney that the Democratic Party, state Democratic Party machine dug up. To run against her, because basically what happened was the current state rep is retiring, and we got like about, I don't know, what would you say, Bob, about a 60% Democrat, 40% Republican city here, more or less?
Yeah, maybe 55 to 45.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but we've got a similar, very similar situation where to where you've got a very, you know, working class, pro-union Democrats out there fighting more of these corporate Democrats. So, yeah, I can really relate to this, and I wonder if how many other places around the country this is happening.
Yeah, I know I did a radio interview, an online one, in New Jersey, and they were shocked at how similar our situation was to their situation, which sounds like it's also just like your situation. So I think it's going on in a lot of places.
Now, let me ask you, though, do you plan on continuing an independent labor party from now and indefinitely, or was this just a sort of a temporary tactic?
You know what? And again, I probably I'll give you my personal opinion.
Sure.
I don't want to speak for others.
Understandable.
I think there's only two solutions going forward. I think either the party remains an independent labor party and continues on the course that we've been going on, or somehow, shape, or form, they get the Democratic Party to actually represent and stand for the values it's supposed to stand for. So I don't know which way. I don't know if there's a peaceful solution or a hostile takeover, or we continue down these two different paths. But I can't see. I can't see the labor groups joining back in with the Democratic Party under its current leadership and its current philosophies.
You know, and there's been an interesting other phenomenon that's happened. Of course, you're probably familiar with this as well, about the socialist candidate for city council in Seattle, Kashama Sawant, who won out there.
Correct.
And in Minneapolis, another candidate on a socialist party ticket just barely lost. I think he got beat 52-48%. So it seems like there's a trend going on here around the country. And, you know, it's kind of a similar, you know, now that I'm kind of, you know, looking at it, after you told me a little bit more here in just the interview, I'm seeing this to be more the case. It seems like whenever the Democratic Party gets a strong position, either where it's a total one-party town or to where they've got a slight advantage, it seems like they start taking working people and labor for granted, and then people start getting fed up with it, and they're starting to look for other alternatives.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect summary. I think even at the national level, I think America is primed and ready for a third party. I ran a campaign that, if I had to say what it was about, it was a populist campaign. It was about you know, the people instead of the political corruption and the good old boys. It was about supporting the middle class. And I don't believe you can support the middle class if you don't support labor. I think labor has been for generations, and still is, the way a lot of people achieve middle class status. So, and that's why I'm so pro labor, not just because I'm a union teacher, but because my family is very much established itself because of labor. My grandfather came from Kentucky in the coal mines and didn't have anything, and got a job at the steel mill. And was able to get my dad a little bit more education than he had. My dad became an electrician at the Ford plant, UAW, and he was able to get me a little bit more education than what he had. So I don't think that's possible in a lot of places where you don't have labor.
Well, indeed, indeed. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because at the national level, like you said, as you well know, and this, of course, happens at the state level as well, and looks like maybe even at some city levels, to where you've got corporations that donate money to both political parties, you know, both candidates in any particular race, so where it ends up to where no matter who wins, they win, and no matter who, you know, who loses, we lose, sort of thing. And so, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of this happening. I mean, there's so much out there, if you look at the polls of what the majority of the American people want, but yet our politicians say it's not quote unquote politically possible, you know, anything
right.
from
yeah, I think as long as mm-hmm. we at the national level, I don't think this two-party system is going to be the solution to our problems.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think the other big issue is campaign finance reform.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If you have corporations funding elections on both sides, you know, there's nobody speaking for the middle class, and I think that's kind of what this Tea Party philosophy has been with, you know, Michigan Right to Work and mm-hmm. Scott Walker in Wisconsin, and Governor Kasich tried to do it here with
yes.
Senate Bill 5, and we were able to defeat it.
Thank God you have the voter referendum possibility in your state constitution, because
yeah, you know what? I think it turned out to be a great thing. We were hoping at first. We were disappointed at first that we didn't have the recall,
mm-hmm.
But in hindsight, I think referendum is a lot easier to achieve than a recall,
mm-hmm.
For sure.
Okay, now let me ask you this: now, since you've been in office here for almost 6 months, how is it at the actual doing the sort of nuts and bolts of local governance?
You know what? It's been a transition. I'm still learning.
Mm-hmm.
Love the job. I love helping people.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it would stop snowing because 80% of my phone calls are either my street hasn't been plowed or my street has been plowed and they blocked the school crossing or mm-hmm. something along those lines. So that's been the rough part. We've had a rough winter here.
Yeah, but, so have we. But I think
yeah,
you've
actually
you know had it
looking
worse.
Forward
yeah.
to kind of advancing some of the. Legislative things that I campaigned on, and they just getting to that point right now. So I'm pretty excited going forward.
Okay, so tell us about some of those that you campaigned on.
Well, the biggest issue that I campaigned on was here city council members are part-time officials. They're compensated $12,000 per year in salary. But the excessive thing, in my opinion, is that they receive public health benefits. Which actually cost the city $15,000. And what's really unfortunate is that you have a lot of people on city council that have other jobs, and then they refuse their insurance through their primary employer and go on the taxpayer's dime, which is very unfortunate.
Yes.
I, along with two other council members, actually refused the city's insurance.
Mm-hmm.
We kept our own. And ended up saving the taxpayers a lot of money by doing that. So the biggest thing I'm working on right now is looking at changing the benefits packets for part-time city officials, both elected and non-elected. We have a part-time law department, and a lot of these guys that work there are, you know, pretty big-time lawyers. They live pretty comfortably, and again, they have other insurance options, but are instead going on the taxpayer's dime, which I don't think is right. I certainly don't want anybody to not have insurance, but if you have it through your primary employer, I don't think you should get it through the city.
Oh, indeed, so, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was just kind of looking over some of my notes here, and it said that one of the pivotal things that caused a lot of anger at the local Democratic Party was the mayor got involved in the Teamster strike and, you know, basically borrowed city trucks from a nearby town and actually worked on the trucks to try to break the sanitation worker strike. I mean, wow. I mean,
yeah, there was that. There was another situation. They had something called a PLA here, Project Labor Agreement.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the mayor decided to get rid of that,
mm-hmm.
Even though, in his own words, most of the projects being done were on time and on budget. you know, and the ironic part of that whole thing is since they got rid of it, they've given out 13 major contracts, and 11 of the 13 major contracts have been won by the same unions that were winning the contracts under the PLA.
Mm-hmm.
And they're finding out that, yeah, they weren't bidding up higher because of the PLA or anything. So it was just, it was a really unfortunate anti-labor move at the city level, that along with the strike-breaking efforts. So, yeah, we haven't really explored too many legislative things in relation to labor at this point. We're still, when the PLA fight happened, unfortunately, it was a public bashing, essentially, so much so that they used some of their power with the media and so forth and kind of really turned people against labor here locally. So we're kind of trying to repair our reputation right now and build up that support first. And then we can look at some legislative options going forward.
When's the mayor come up for election?
Mayor is up in about a year and a half.
It'd be, considering what this guy's done, it'd be interesting if you guys could run somebody against him. Maybe you might run.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I love teaching. It would be really hard for me to ever see taking a full-time political position just because I love getting up every day, and I teach eighth grade social studies, history, and government. And it's awesome. So I don't know about me running, but
yeah.
I definitely think you know, there's candidates out there that might be running. I think the mayor still he's going to be hard to beat. He's very popular among independents, Republicans, and Democrats. And we've made a lot of progress in the city since he's been mayor. Unfortunately, like I said, there's been some pretty anti-labor stuff happened as well.
Yes. Well, Joshua, thank you so much for calling in and, you know, giving us this report. I think this has really been enlightening, and wish you the best of luck and everything. And, you know, we'll hope maybe here, in, I don't know, sometime down the road, maybe we can get you back on and you can kind of give us a little update. What's going on?
Oh, certainly. Anytime. Again, I appreciate it. It's very, very humbling to do a radio interview.
Well,
so I thank you guys very much.
Well,
thank you.
Likewise, because we're honored to have you on and stuff. I was surprised, frankly, you accepted my invitation, considering all the press you've been getting here. But I think you guys, you and your fellow workers out there are kind of you're a trend to come, I'm hoping. So keep fighting a good fight.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
That was Tom Morell again. Which side are you on? And you're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Supported Community Radio Station WFT, and from Champaign, Illinois, and broadcasting worldwide at weft.org. Anyway, just want some public service announcements here. The monthly anti-war demonstration by Aware, the anti-war and racism effort, will happen today at 2 p.m. at the corner of Neal Street and Main in downtown Champaign. Tune in today at 2 p.m. also for Not Another Sports Show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen on WRFU 104.5 FM and televised on Urbana Public Television Comcast Channel 6 at Urbanapublictelevision.org on Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m. Also, check out Labor's Worldview TV this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 as well. And check out the Midwatch Show with Reasonable Man Stan Wednesdays here on WFT from 6 to 8 p.m. And Bob, you had some public service announcements as well?
Yeah, a couple other things happening around the station here. We do have an associates meeting coming up this Thursday, March 6th at 7 p.m. at the Urbana Civic Center. It's all are welcome to attend, and this meeting is a great way to learn more about WEFT and become more involved in your community radio station. We have quarterly associates meetings, and this is the first quarter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, first quarter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Thursday, March 6th at 7 p.m. at the Urbana Civic Center. It's a chance to come in and participate, maybe become more involved with WEFT, maybe a chance to get your own show here and whatnot. So come on in. And also, WEFT is going to have a spring jazz benefit going on at the Iron Post. That's over there in Urbana, the corner of Race and Elm Street. That's going to be happening on Sunday, March 16th at 6 p.m. Going to have three different great jazz groups there, Chip Stevens and Larry Gray, Brad Wheeler, and the Reginald Chapman Group. So this is another chance to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Admission's only $10, with all the proceeds going to not-for-profit radio station WEFT Champaign. And a couple more underwriters here, I suppose. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. I noted that our last phone guest was a member of the OEA.
Yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm. Part of the National Education Association, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, very good, Bob. So, this is interesting. I mean, you know, this, like I said, this confirmed something that I kind of suspected about how, you know, a lot of this stuff is going on all over the country is what's happened out here in Lorain County, Ohio, mm-hmm. and other places. And you know, it's just amazing. I mean, I've always considered a lot of this stuff just as a big game of connecting the dots. I mean, there's, you know, even with the internet, there's so much out there going on. You know,
there's
different
a lot going on
that
like
we don't
you
know
mentioned
about.
In Seattle.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. SeaTac, the town, passed a $15 per hour
That's
minimum
right.
wage out there.
Mm-hmm.
The part of the program here that we're going to have on Union Edge here, they're talking to Buck Gino out of Michigan. And restaurants and places up there that have a $15 an hour starting wage and stuff,
oh, okay.
fast food restaurants. And they
oh,
said,
wow.
if small mom and pops can do it or these chains with 32 restaurants can do it, mm-hmm. why can't the national chains
wow.
do it? You know?
Okay, that's definitely throwing the gauntlet down, yes.
Right, right. You know, as I mentioned earlier in the show, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, who passed away this week, you know, there's people out there that are doing good things, mm-hmm. standing up for workers, the middle class, and for the people in this country. And maybe sometimes, like you say, the Democrats, or as our phone guest called them, the pretendocrats.
Pretendocrats. That
you
was
know,
good.
It was really good.
Yeah.
You know, and the Republicans, they're not representing the people out there anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe it's time people start stepping up and voting for people that do truly support them.
Okay.
Know?
All right, we're going to end with a little Black Eyed Peas. The song is called Union, and you've been listening to the World Labor Hour.
I got a quick update.
Update. You know? Okay. Yes, please.
Well,
please.
A couple of weeks ago, somebody called in and asked about what was going on with the workers down in Metropolis, Illinois.
Oh, yes, yes.
At the Honeywell plant down there.
Uh-huh.
And so I looked, and the latest thing I could see was, once again, they were talking back at Christmas time. That they had hired back all of the workers that had been locked out.
Okay.
They had stopped at like 21 left to hire back or whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And so apparently right around December 13th, they announced they were going to hire back the remaining of the workers and stuff. So they all got their jobs back on the 23rd of December. The union down there, USW7-699, is saying thanks to the company for finally doing that, new Honeywell plant manager Jim Pritchett. And although they have some problems with some of their people who I retired and seemed to be going back into the factory and contracting to maybe replace some of the union machinists there and stuff.
But, oh, man.
You know, so, but that they say that, you know, he's one of their own, and now he's back in the plant working as a contractor. He's making $65 an hour to train contractors to replace the union mechanics in the machine shop. So, but all the workers were hired back.
Okay.
Finally, after years, you know.
Man.
Some of them had been laid off 13 months and some 23 months. So, incredible.
Wow. Indeed, indeed. Well, thanks for that update, Bob. So, anyway, this has been the World Labor Hour, and we're going to leave you with a little music from Black Eyed Peas. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.
It's drastic time for sure. We need an antidote and a cure. Cause do you really think Muhammad got a problem with Jehovah? We don't want war. Imagine if every prophet was alive. And current days amongst you and I. You think they would view life like you and I do? Or would they sit and contemplate on why do we live this way? Act and behave this way? We still living primitive today. Cause the peace of the destination in war can't be the way. There's no way. So people just be a woman, be a man. Realize that you can change the world by changing yourself. And understand that we all just the same. So when I count to three, let's change.
Time for grand philosophy. I barely keep my head above the tide. I got this mortgage, got three kids in school. What you're saying is the truth, but really troubles me inside. I'd change the world if I could change my mind. If I could live beyond my fears. Exchanging unity for all my insecurity. Exchanging laughter for my tears.
Welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor Stock Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. Joining me now on the telephone, we have Buck Gino of Work in Progress Radio. Buck, welcome back.
Charles, it's always a pleasure to be with you. We at Work in Progress and enjoy participating on the Union Edge.
It's always a pleasure, man. We appreciate your insight and what you guys are doing up in Michigan. Buck, you and I were talking a little bit earlier. One of the things we're going to be talking about today is the Michigan Chamber of Commerce and the restaurant businesses all out assault against the minimum wage. And I just did reach out to our friends at Moo Cluck Moo. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to get anybody today. For those of you who don't know, Moo Cluck Moo is a hamburger restaurant. Great burgers. I mean, these things are like the size of a dinner plate. I couldn't finish the one I had. But great burgers and great people working there. And starting wage at this restaurant, and it's a quick serve restaurant, is $15 an hour in the heart of Detroit, Michigan. Okay? Telegraph Road. If you're ever in Detroit, go to Telegraph, go to Moo Cluck Moo. Great food.
Exactly.
As a matter of fact, I called up there trying to get a hold of one of the owners. Couldn't do it. He said the staffer that I was talking to said, can we call back later because they're in the middle of their lunch rush. They're getting clobbered. So there you go. They are doing business hand over fist. They have more than one. The second one just opened up. This is a great thing. Great people working there.